From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Our children are getting sicker. That is a fact. Government data shows that more than half of American children and teenagers live with some sort of chronic condition. While it might not be apparent to parents who have only small number statistics to contend with, pediatricians who see hundreds of young patients a year are alarmed by what is transpiring. Among the conditions facing children are food allergies, asthma, Crohn's disease, childhood diabetes, ADHD, autism, and even chronic headaches and migraines. Now, a bold new book attempts to pin down the causes of the rise in these conditions and focuses in on our industrial food system that is rife with the overuse of pesticides, antibiotics, synthetic hormones, and more. My guest is Dr. Michelle Perrault. She is a pediatrician with over 35 years of experience in acute and integrative medicine. She's worked as director of the Pediatric Emergency Department at New York's Metropolitan Hospital and attending physician at UCSF's Benioff Children's Hospital in Oakland, California. And she's the co-author with Professor Vincent Adams of the new book, What's Making Our Children Sick? How Industrial Food is Causing an Epidemic of Chronic Illness and What Parents and Doctors Can Do About It. Welcome to the program, Dr. Perrault.
Sonali, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So I mentioned a sort of list of the diseases that children seem to be, you know, are facing and the government's data. But I'd love to hear from your perspective, because sometimes it's easy to dismiss the rise in these conditions as just overdiagnosis, or maybe more parents are more aware now, so they're getting their children diagnosed, and that the rise in these diseases may not be real. So what do you, how do you explain this from the perspective of a pediatrician who has seen, you know, over many, many years, these conditions?
Absolutely, Sonali. So it appears that what we were first told as clinicians, even that, gee, there's not an increase in autism, autistic spectrum disorder, but that we're just better at diagnosing this. And that's what we were first told 15 to 20 years ago when we started seeing these alarming trends using autism as an example. Autism actually is not a very difficult diagnosis to make. These children have profound issues. And so what it's clear is that what we told was initially, we're better at diagnosing, turns out not to be true. The statistics are profound. Whereas when I did my residency 30 years ago, autism rates were 1 in 10,000 children. Last checked in 2016, the rates for boys was 1 in 43 boys, 1 in 68 kids, and I've seen recent stats that it's actually increasing further. This is not better diagnosis. This is profound CDC-generated data, and by definition, an epidemic.
So what you're saying is that the just for taking autism as an example, the symptoms are pretty apparent. They're not something that you think, you know, that you would imagine parents would ignore or were ignoring 10, 20, 30 years ago. If parents saw these in their children, very likely they would have brought them to doctors for diagnoses. And so because they're pretty strong symptoms, it's not just better diagnosis, it's that the incidence is likely really increasing.
Correct again. Now, that's why we call it autistic spectrum, and we're kind of honing in on that because it's such a profound change in American children. And there is some very subtle forms of autism and more profound. However, don't underestimate a family, parents, particularly mom's ability to sense when something's wrong with her children or her child, even when it's subtle, because moms know. And we, as pediatricians, are trained to listen to parents, particularly women. When women say, there's something wrong with my kid, there often is. And we respectfully need to listen to that.
And so aside from autism, I mentioned a few other a series of illnesses. I know food allergies is a big one. Anybody who has parents in a public school or any kind of a school, you often hear, well, there might be a handful of kids who have very severe peanut allergies, that even if they're, you know, even if they breathe in some peanut dust might cause them to be in a life-threatening condition. And we're just seeing a bigger and bigger spectrum of foods that children are unable to tolerate. Is this also something that can't just be relegated to better diagnosis these days?
Again, another problem, which is not so, it's not easy to miss. Food allergies are now, children in America have about 40% of them have food allergies. It's become such a problem, Sonali, that schools in California are required to carry EpiPens, the life-saving measure to treat severe life-threatening food allergies. But in addition, what we're also seeing, besides the life-threatening food allergies, are food intolerances, where children are just unable to tolerate certain foods with low-grade chronic inflammation, even though they may not have the severe reactions, the life-threatening ones. So we're seeing an alarming increase in almost all types of food allergies, from very mild to very severe.
There's also sort of respiratory diseases. Asthma is a huge one. It's heartbreaking to see children who have to deal with asthma, carrying around the respirators. And of course, also the issue of childhood diabetes, where we see an obesity. So these are very, very serious issues for parents who have to, who have children struggling with these issues. It can be a little bit mystifying to figure out, why is this happening to my child? So you have the benefit of many years of experience and large number statistics, rather than, a parent who might have one or two or three children and who might just think, okay, it's just bad luck that my kids have this. Let's talk about the industrial food system and why you and your co-author honed in on the food we put into our bodies as a potential source, or one potential source, that we need to figure out it's linked to these chronic illnesses. Why the industrial food system?
So let's be clear, Sonali, there are many reasons that our children are getting sick now in terms of the environment, water, toxicants that they're being exposed to, plastics, EMFs. The list is profound. But what we do know is that children eat, and they eat a lot. I know I certainly do, 3, 4, occasionally 5 times a day. I'm kind of embarrassed to admit. So also, for their tiny bodies, they're consuming quite a bit of food for what they need for growth. And also remember that children are not little adults. So they handle their food in a different way than we do. And they have a more rapid cell turnover and more rapid metabolism, that they utilize it more. In addition, if food is more toxic for whatever reasons, and we can get into the weeds, so to speak, they don't detoxify as well as adults, and we can go into why that is. So they're needing more food for size than we do, and have a decreased ability to clear toxic elements. So it's a double-edged sword for our little kids.
In a way, our children are the canaries in the coal mine.
Indeed, and we talk about it in the book. We go into, they are a living science experiment, and they are the canaries in the coal mine. And we have been looking at this. I've been on it for about 2 decades of my almost 4-decade career. I've asked myself this every day: why? What's happening? Let's identify it. Let's get to the root cause. Can I study it, and can I help them? I ask myself that all the time.
So some of the obvious things that have been identified in sort of the mainstream are that we eat unhealthily, that, children consume far too much sugar, our cereals are sugary, processed food and sodas, sugary sodas can't be good for kids. And certainly we could link those to things like childhood obesity and diabetes. So how much of the industrial food system that involves unhealthy eating is part of the culprit?
It is really hard to delineate sometimes, because we know the bad players. Everybody knows about processed foods and the sugary foods and the sodas and
the high fructose corn syrup.
High fructose corn syrup, indeed, and additives added to processed foods and packaged foods. Those we are all pretty clear about. But what parents are now challenged with are things that they thought were healthy foods, offering those to their families, that are also have high levels of contaminants. And that's what we go into. So parents are caught between this rock and the hard place. They clearly know that things like soda, not exactly a health food, but now things that they thought were healthy, such as foods that, like corn, for example, we can look at corn and go into that, have issues as well. And that's been going on in the U.S. and it's a global issue, Sonali, not just at home, for the past 20 years, and it's increasing.
So pesticides is a huge issue. Let's talk about that. Now, the idea behind pesticides is that you apply extremely small levels of a poison to the plant you're going to consume that will kill pests, insects and diseases, fungus, whatever. But because it's applied in small quantities, our bodies can process it and we wouldn't drink a glass of pesticide, but it's okay to eat a piece of, you know, some produce that's been sprayed with pesticide. That's the idea behind using pesticides on our foods. Why is that problematic?
It's problematic with the introduction of genetically modified foods in 1996. These were foods created to resist dying when sprayed with Roundup, which is a glyphosate-containing herbicide. Glyphosate is the main ingredient in Roundup. And so these plants, such as soy, corn, canola, alfalfa, which our cattle and livestock eat, are genetically modified to withstand the spraying so that when farmers apply this pesticide, the crop doesn't die. Before genetically modified crops, farmers couldn't spray the crop, the plants would die. So they could only spray pre-harvest. But now they spray pre, during, and actually after harvest as a desiccant to dry out certain crops such as wheat. So in addition to that, we now have this massive issue of weed resistance. Approximately 75% of weeds in the U.S. are resistant to this preparation, and agribusiness has to learn and it has made more toxic pesticides and herbicides. So kids are not only getting genetically modified food, they're getting increasing levels of these herbicides, and we're now seeing in significant levels of toxicity, and the research is pouring out on lab animals. We have no human data, which is shocking to me, Sonali, that we don't have human studies, but the laboratory animal data is pretty alarming.
Let's focus on this for a minute, because the issue of GMOs is hugely controversial. You know, there are some who avoid GMOs just because they don't like the idea of DNA being manipulated in a lab. And there's been some studies that are controversial. The companies that manufacture GMOs have spent a lot of money on them and have a lot of their own data and their own quote-unquote scientific studies that prove that they are, or try to prove that they are safe. Sometimes even folks who are very skeptical of big agribusiness say there is just not enough data to suggest genetically modified organisms are any worse for your health than non-GMOs, except if you hone in on the pesticide use, there's a pretty clear difference, right? So if you set aside whether the chemical nature of a GMO food is, you know, what it might be doing in your body, the fact is that these plants have been designed to withstand high pesticide use. So they go hand in hand with high pesticide use, which can't be good for us. Is that clear? Does that make sense?
Sonali, yeah, you've done your homework, my dear. Yes.
I'm a mom. I've done my homework as a mom.
We are all educators of our N of 1, 2, 3, or 4, correct? I had the same skepticism when I started looking at this in 2006. In 2006, a mom, a colleague of mine said, "Hey, Michelle, what do you think about GMOs?" And I said, "Not much. What should I think about GMOs?" Well, she sent me to reading Jeffrey Smith and one of his books, and I finally found some original research on the genetic modification process by Dr. Arpad Pusti, simple and brilliant. And he showed very clearly that there is an issue with the genetic modification process. And he came out as a hero in England at that time in 98, I believe. And then he was fired 2 days later. It's a massive story. And he did a movie about it. But there have been studies since Dr. Pusti, which was over 20 years ago, that have showed that the GM process is a problem. Now, I said, when I started looking at this, we cannot figure out what's caused by genetically modification and what's caused by the GM and the pesticide. When we eat those foods, they're linked. Dr. Seralini showed there are problems when you eat the GM food and the pesticide, a researcher out of France. And we know that to be true. There are problems on livers, kidney, immune function. It's pretty profound. And if you Google it, you find it. It's not hard to see this data. And parents, doctor moms have to go to Dr. Google and figure this stuff out. It's very findable online. So we know that these problems exist both alone and together.
Now, there's also an issue with the way in which the precautionary principle is applied here in the United States or not applied outside of the U.S. and Canada and Europe. Governments require that companies prove a chemical is safe before it's allowed to be used. Here in the U.S., it's turned over on its head. The public has to prove that something might be killing us before it's tested and taken off the market. And there's a huge controversy around glyphosate, which is one of the main ingredients of Monsanto's pesticides. And there have been debates in the European Parliament about it. There was an attempt to ban it from Europe. And again, we have this idea that small amounts of these toxins are fine for us, except now we're finding out that human bodies are actually much more sensitive to these toxic chemicals than we thought they were. That goes doubly for children, right?
So Nali, once again, right on. Dr. Michael Antonio just came out with a study about a year ago, which showed that Roundup at 2 parts per billion, which is way less than we're getting in our food, caused, not correlated, there's a difference there, right, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is a massive problem affecting adults now, 1 in 4 adults, affecting children as well, particularly obese children, and affecting 93% of workers who are farm workers in areas such as Central America, such as Nicaragua, and other areas because they are toxic from the spraying. So liver toxicity is not a good thing. Love your liver, protect your liver. So this idea that dose makes the poison is outdated. We know that at extremely low levels, chemicals such as Roundup are toxic, both on the liver and endocrine disruption. Many pesticides, including Roundup, have shown endocrine disruption at extremely low levels. And this is important, an important message.
Now, let's focus on the part of your book, which I think parents are going to be most interested, which is what can parents do about it? I mean, it's hard enough to try to navigate the various dangers that our children face on a day-to-day basis. If you want to make sure your kids are eating healthy, you might want to feed them lots of greens cleaner meats. But as we've found, unless you're buying or certified organic produce, which can be expensive, et cetera, it can be a very, very difficult way. It can be a very difficult thing to not turn your children into science experiments. What can parents do about this?
It's tough, and parents are navigating this rough road of what do I feed my kid? And I think we are not at the doom and gloom stage, and I like to leave on, an optimistic note and not bounce all over this during this interview. I get very excited about this topic. What we can do, first of all, yes, we have to eat as organic as we can, but not just organic bagged food and processed food, but whole foods. And this is challenging because conventionally grown foods are subsidized by the government. Organic farmers are not. So I ask parents to do the best that they can. And we try not to go for perfection, but do the best they can. And if they cannot buy organic completely, can they just avoid GMOs, which I feel are not good for the health? And that's basically corn and soy for most kids and canola. If they could avoid those foods and buy those foods organic, already better health. I ask parents, can they get a water filter, even a simple water filter, like a one you put in the fridge? And lastly, I say, can you possibly decrease the toxic load in the child's external environment as well? Taking shoes off at the door, for example, using less toxic cleaning products or personal care. So we are trying to rebalance a child's internal and external environment. And in the book, Dr. Adams and I discuss this concept of eco-medicine, that it's all important. We are holistic beings and we are not separate from our environment. Hmm.
And there are some very simple things one can do just even in terms of, we didn't even get to talking about the chemicals in things like shampoo and soaps that are packaged and marketed to children, toothpaste, you know, with artificial colors and chemicals to make them look bright and pretty, all of those things, you know, yes. Scented lotions. There are options that are unscented that are as basic as you can possibly get them, that it's much better to just put those on kids, because why would you want to take a chance? I want to also ask you, because I know that some among my audience are going to wonder about this. We started talking about the issue of autism, and there is a huge fear among parents about the link between autism and vaccines. And I'm wondering where you stand on that, because a lot of parents want to be able to, I think parents, especially of kids seeing autism, want to be able to link one simple, easy cause for what is making their children autistic. What is your position on vaccines and the links to autism?
You know, it's a question that's come up just about with so many of the dialogues we have regarding the book. And because I take care of chronically ill children, I've been out of the vaccine issue because I don't do primary care. And primary care physicians are the ones who do the vaccines. So I've not been involved, and I've really managed to kind of stay out of that dialogue and focus on GM food and glyphosate, which is a hotbed enough in terms of the dialogue. So I'm not stepped in it. However, I would say this. I'm always interested in giving our children the least toxic, most effective treatment we can use, whether I'm using herbs, supplements, homeopathics, vaccines, Western medicine. For example, if I need to give a child an antibiotic, which I occasionally do, I say, does it need to contain dyes? Does it need to have that yucky pink stuff in there? Can we make a cleaner product? I also ask vaccine industry, all pharmaceutical industry, what's the cleanest product we can make to give our children the most effective product? And I think we could do better with the vaccine industry as well. So I would leave it at that and to my vaccine colleagues to sort out. I kind of stick to the dirt and the soil and the microbes and food.
Well, I'm not ashamed to say that I am a strong proponent of vaccines. I don't want to see polio return. I don't want to see measles return. I am very proudly giving my children the vaccines that they need, including the flu vaccine. We know this year's California flu has been incredibly bad and resulted in numbers of deaths, especially among infants who are too young to receive it. So I stand by my decision after having done my mom research behind vaccines. I appreciate what you said about all of the dyes, et cetera, because that's also an issue. Marketers, corporations feel like for some reason they have to make things pastel shades of pink and blue and flavored, cherry flavored, ibuprofen, and all of this crap, toothpaste with colors and flavors in it, because they feel like our children wouldn't want it otherwise. And that is something that really upsets me, because that's extra additives that children don't need. And we don't know yet why, you know, what constant artificial colors and flavors are doing to our children.
It's one of my biggest bugaboos, Sonali. I agree with you. Dr. Adams and I are pretty clear. We're strong proponents of giving vaccines, but we do it in a way. We recommend that things should be healthy. And I get crazy when I see what's in these pharmaceuticals like ibuprofen. I think we can do better. We can make a cleaner product. You can get cleaner products, by the way, through compounding pharmacies, but it is expensive and not convenient for parents who are looking for ibuprofen at 10 p.m. on a Friday night. You're not contacting your compounding pharmacy. It's for a very elite, very sophisticated group of parents whose children, those parents are often of children who are very sick. And sometimes those children can't tolerate anything and they've entered that world. But no doubt we can do better for our kids by giving them cleaner products.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Pera, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Your book is certainly a fascinating read for parents, and I recommend it to them. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sonali, thanks for having me. I enjoyed chatting with you.
My guest has been Dr. Michelle Perro. She's a pediatrician with over 35 years of experience in acute and integrative medicine. She's worked as director of the Pediatric Emergency Department at New York's Metropolitan Hospital, as well as attending physician at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital in Oakland. We've been discussing the new book she's just co-authored with Professor Vincent Adams. It's called What's Making Our Children Sick? How Industrial Food is Causing an Epidemic of Chronic Illness and What Parents and Doctors Can Do About It. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.